mayor and said, who wants to work on the gas line? And so I said, well, I'll work on the gas line. I worked on the oil line, so I'm happy to work on the gas line.
Governor Walker's ambitions for a gas line started as a young city council member in Valdez. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a push by Senator Murkowski for more transparency in Navy training in Alaska.
There was assurance by Navy that, well, after the exercise, we'll basically provide answers to the questions people have, and they haven't done it.
Support for news on APRN is provided by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The announcement this summer that Alaska will pursue a state-owned natural gas pipeline is a U-turn after more than a decade of negotiations with the big North Slope oil companies. But one person has been advocating this approach all along, Governor Bill Walker. This week, Alaska's Energy Desk is exploring the state's 40-year quest for a natural gas pipeline in part two of our series, Pipeline Promises. Rachel Waldholz looks at Walker's lifelong mission to get a gas line built.
About a year ago, Governor Bill Walker stood before reporters. He was addressing his most recent dust-up with the state's oil companies. And in a moment of exasperation, he said, look, guys.
It has to do with controlling our destiny. And I stand firm on that principle.
This is the heart of the Bill Walker philosophy. This gas line, this piece of pipe, as he calls it, is central to Alaska's destiny, and it is never going to get built unless the state takes charge. He argues we can't leave it to the oil companies. Now, Alaska has a chance to test that theory. And for the man in the driver's seat, the seeds of this philosophy were planted almost 50 years ago with the state's other pipeline, the oil pipeline.
I mean, I graduated from high school in 69 in Valdez, and I could not afford to go to college. I mean, there's no way I could afford to go to college.
What saved him, he says, was early work on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. He still remembers getting his dispatch, the piece of paper that called him up for a job on the project.
I've gotten a number of degrees in my life. I can't tell you a single name of the person who gave me, but I can tell you the name of the person who gave me that dispatch. His name was Jim Robinson. He was in the Johnson Trailer Court in Valdez, and I thought, this is my ticket for my future.
Walker says what the last pipeline meant to him, the next line would mean for a whole new generation. Jobs, revenue for the state, cheap energy that could launch whole new industries, and new incentive for companies to explore the North Slope. His first encounter with the gas line came a few years after that moment in the Valdez Trailer Court. Walker was in his mid-20s. He'd just met his wife and was serving on the Valdez City Council.
The mayor said, who wants to work on the gas line? And so I said, well, I'll work on the gas line. I worked on the oil line, so I'm happy to work on the gas line.
That version of the project fizzled, like so many after it. But Walker stayed involved in oil and gas, and often found himself at odds with the state's dominant industry. In the late 90s, the gas line came back into his life. He was called to a meeting of mayors from the North Slope, Fairbanks, and Valdez.
They had formed a group called Gasline Now. I said, what can we do to add a few more, you know, percentage of return to the gas line so the producers would build a gas line.
The idea was to jumpstart a project by using the local government's tax-free status to try to tempt the oil companies to the table. Walker ended up working with the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority for more than a decade, trying to advance what he called an all-Alaska gas line.
Bill wasn't doing academic papers. Bill was doing the real deal. He's meeting Fortune 500 companies, and it was just very enticing.
Craig Richards went to work for Walker as a 27-year-old lawyer in the early 2000s. He went on to become Walker's law partner, confidant, and ultimately his first attorney general. Richards says the Port Authority years taught Walker several things. There were moments when Walker thought he'd pulled it off. He brought in big outside companies who were interested in making a project happen. They'd reach out to the North Slope producers who controlled the gas, but
phone never rang. Dead silence, because the producers weren't interested in that stage in making a pipeline happen. They were interested in accomplishing other goals.
Goals like using gas line negotiations with the state to lock in their oil and gas taxes, Richard says. Critics say the Port Authority never put together enough of a project to merit a real response. But Richard says, for him and Walker, the lessons were clear. The oil companies have their own priorities and their own timeline. If the state wants a gas line, it can't wait for the companies to lead the way.
One, he decided that he needed to be governor if he was going to, you know, really see the gas line go to the next phase, and that was the beginning of his political ambitions. And two, he realized that it's got to be the state of Alaska that does this.
In 2010, Walker ran against then-Governor Sean Parnell in the Republican primary, with the gas line as his main issue.
Folks ask me if I'm a one-issue candidate. Now, I'll admit, and it's certainly no secret, I am committed to Alaskans building the All-Alaska Gas Line.
Walker lost in 2010, but he ran again in 2014. By then, Parnell and Republican lawmakers were advancing a new plan, a partnership with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Bill Walker was not a fan. Here's what he told KTVA reporter Rhonda McBride at the time.
The fatal flaw of what he's doing is that, again, he has put the control of Alaska's future in the hands of companies that have competing projects around the world.
Then, the unexpected. Walker won the election. Former Anchorage Daily News reporter Bill White has researched the history of the gas line, and I asked him if Walker's single-minded pursuit of a state-owned project is his white whale, his Moby Dick.
It's his big obsession, for sure. Remains to be seen whether it's his white whale.
Why? Because?
Well, maybe he's right. I wouldn't bet on it, but maybe he's right.
And now Walker has a chance to prove it. When he took office, oil and gas prices were plunging. Suddenly, Alaska faced a massive revenue shortfall, and Walker was more convinced than ever that a gas line is the solution. Low prices also changed the dynamics of the project he had inherited from Parnell, offering him an unexpected opening. Early this year, the state's three oil company partners sat down with Walker's team.
It was a day I'll never forget.
February 9th, 2016. According to both Walker and ExxonMobil, the companies told him that lousy market conditions and slow negotiations meant they probably couldn't move the project ahead as planned. They proposed either slowing down or letting the state take over. And for Walker, this was his moment.
I thought, my goodness, how long have we waited for this opportunity?
For many Alaskans, news that the big three oil companies are stepping back from the project is a sign that the state's gas line dream has hit another wall. But Walker doesn't see it that way.
We have proved over the last 40 years what won't work. It's the first time we've said, let's try it one time, like other sovereign do around the world.
In his words, it's not a wall. It's a starting gate. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
In part three of the series tomorrow, we'll profile Keith Meyer, the man in charge of leading the state down this new path. For more on our series, Pipeline Promises, connect with Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the Navy is again snubbing the concerns of Alaskans as it prepares for the next Northern Edge. That's a military exercise held every 2 years that stretches from the Gulf of Alaska into the interior. The next Northern Edge is scheduled for May. Murkowski says more than 100 Alaskans sent her letters this summer with concerns about the potential impact of the exercise, particularly on fish and marine mammals.
When the exercise moved forward in 2015, after a great deal of concern being expressed by the coastal communities, there was assurance by Navy that, well, after the exercise, we'll basically provide answers to the questions people have. And they haven't done it.
Murkowski sent a sternly worded letter to the Secretary of the Navy last week calling for more transparency. She also chided the Navy for denying Alaska biologist Rick Steiner's request under the Freedom of Information Act for reports on the impact of Northern Edge 2015. 2 years ago, military representatives said people were misinformed about the scope of the exercise. They said environmental impact documents described dropping far more ordnance into the Gulf than the Navy Navy actually intended to use. Today, Air Force Captain Anastasia Wassum of Alaskan Command said the military is finalizing its public outreach plans.
So far, they include having representation at events such as the Alaskan Federation of Natives, also the Alaska Forum on the Environment, and ComFish. And in addition to that, we're going to be trying to work with the cities of Kodiak, Cordova, Homer, and Seward to go to meetings for their Chamber of Commerce and City Council and also perhaps Rotary Clubs.
Wassum says the exercise was moved from June to May, in part so the military can save money on airfare and lodging, and also so its aircraft won't complicate air traffic control during high wildfire season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula brace for a big windstorm.
Right now, we're seeing already gusts. We actually got a gust of 70 miles per hour on the hillside.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
High wind warnings go into effect tonight throughout the eastern Kenai Peninsula and Anchorage. The National Weather Service predicts hurricane-force winds, with the strongest winds heightening late tonight through Wednesday morning. A high wind warning goes into effect starting at 9 p.m. tonight until 1 p.m. tomorrow for East Anchorage, the Lower Hillside, and Eagle River. The high wind warning for Turnagain Arm and higher hillside elevation starts at 7 p.m. tonight and continues through Wednesday afternoon. NWS meteorologist Jason Ossenmacher.
We have not seen any major changes in the storm. It does look like it may be coming in slightly faster, which may change the potential end time tomorrow. The low is developing as expected, and it's pretty much a game of wait and see now.
The strongest winds are predicted for Turnagain Arm and Anchorage's hillside. Gusts of 75 miles per hour up to 90 miles per hour are predicted for much of the area, including Eagle River, East Anchorage, and the Anchorage Bowl. Gusts of 100 miles an hour are possible in Turnagain Arm.
These type of wind events are tricky because there's different phases to the actual event. So right now, we're seeing already gusts. We actually got a gust of 70 miles per hour on the hillside, upper hillside, kind of upper D'Armond Road area. Whereas, you know, in town, we're only getting gusts into the 20, 25 mile per hour range. The mountain ranges, like near Eagle River, we've been seeing gusts already to 40 miles an hour. So it depends on where you're at.
Ossenmacher says the strongest winds will come as the front moves to the north on Wednesday morning. NWS has extended the high wind warning to Tetitlik through Cordova as the storm progresses toward Prince William Sound. The storm is coming in from the Bering Sea and is expected to affect aviation and marine activities, and a storm warning is in effect for Lower Cook Inlet and the entire Gulf of Alaska. Heavy rains are coming along with the high winds starting tonight. Flood watches have been issued for Seward and the eastern Kenai Peninsula this evening and extending through Wednesday. Weather forecasters are predicting 5 to 7 inches of rain in the Seward area. The flood watch includes the cities of Whittier, Girdwood, and Moose Pass and continues through Thursday morning. Residents of the Northwest Arctic community of Kotzebue will revisit whether or not they want the city to be dry. Since October of 2011, the city-owned Kotzebue package store has been selling alcohol. Come October 4th, local voters will decide the fate of the store when they're asked if the city should ban alcohol sales again. KNOM's Tyler Stupp reports.
Hans Nelson, resident of Kotzebue since 2009, says he led the alcohol ban solo, from initial petition through signature collection and onto the ballot.
So I was a lone soldier on the venture. You know, there were folks that wanted to volunteer and participate, but it was an opportunity for me to at least not only hear those that were concerned, but also be able to tell the story because I had done so much reading and a lot of background information involving local option.
Ons started the petition in July and by mid-August had secured the 193 voter signatures needed to put the issue on the ballot. He says it's a moral issue.
The moral side of it is that alcohol in itself has affected many of our homes, in particular to our elders, and it's also affected many of our youth.
He says the petition appeals to business arguments as well, citing concerning language on the 2015 audit of the package store's revenue.
We were unable to perform audit procedures over the package store inventory, and we issued a disclaimer of opinion on the package store major fund. There are no formal procedures for performing a physical inventory count and no policies and procedures for reconciling the general ledger to the year-end inventory listing.
Kotzebue City Attorney Joe Evans says that the language surrounding the audit isn't a sign of business mismanagement at all. He adds that is what audits are for in the first place, namely to identify better business practices, and that this year's audit has eliminated last year's problems. The package store was in the black by October 2011. Those profits have bought loaders, a new snowblower, a garbage truck, and police vehicles, amongst other community improvements and loan payments. Joe Evans says the revenue funded some larger projects as well.
The city borrowed $3.5 million from Wells Fargo Bank and used $2.2 million of that to construct a youth center and approximately $1.3 million to finish the Swan Lake small boat harbor.
As of now, $1 million of that $3.5 million has been paid off. Current package store profits go exclusively towards repaying that debt in addition to expanding the parks department and providing recreational opportunities for children and elders. If the city loses alcohol sales, they will lose an important portion of enterprise revenue. Without alcohol profits, Evans doesn't know where the city will make up the lost funds.
Municipal government does not operate at a profit. So public works, police, fire, parks and rec, none of them generate revenue. They need revenue to operate. The only enterprise activity that the city operates that generates net revenue is the package store.
If the city is unable to make the payments, they will default on the loan. Reporting in Nome, I'm Tyler Stupp.
Federal prosecutors in Alaska have charged four men with killing walrus gathered on the northwest shore last year, removing the animal's ivory tusks and leaving the meat to waste. Prosecutors say the four residents of the village of Point Hope twice caused several hundred walrus to stampede, knowing that smaller animals in the herd could be crushed. A person connected to a remote Air Force radar station in mid-September 2015 photographed 25 dead walrus at Cape Lisburn, about 230 miles northeast of the Bering Strait. 12 pups were among the dead. Only Alaska natives who live in the state may hunt walrus. Prosecutors say all four men were qualified to take marine mammals for subsistence purposes. Walrus killed only for ivory is considered wasteful, and headhunting is illegal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A recent complaint filed with the Food and Drug Administration alleges that mismanagement and financial impropriety at the Blood Bank of Alaska led to dangerously short supplies of blood this summer. The story has been followed closely by the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes spoke with reporter DJ Summers of the Journal. Summers says there were two stories.
The first one came out in early August. And that was in response to some rumors that there'd been an export agreement with a California blood bank, LifeStream. The Blood Bank of Alaska agreed to sell LifeStream 100 units of blood every week. So I wrote a story about that, responding to that. And the second concerned a complaint that a group of blood bank employees filed with the Food and Drug Administration, alleging that there were some dangerous donor conditions, that there were some blood shortages that were specifically related to the export agreement with LifeStream.
Well, how common are these blood sharing agreements? I mean, the one with LifeStream in California, is it abnormal for a blood bank to be selling or giving blood to other locations around the country?
Absolutely not. These are very, very common agreements with blood banks in larger metropolitan areas, Chicago, New York. So they have a lot of violent injuries, things like that, and they demand just a lot more blood. Typically, they will reach out to blood banks in less dangerous areas, Idaho, Colorado, Montana, in this case, Alaska, to keep a fresh supply of blood.
Are blood shortages a big deal? I mean, is that something that employees were just filing out of a procedural interest, or is this something that actually does kind of pose a medical threat?
It was very much related to an issue of public, well, a concern for public health. And again, these are allegations. I can't verify any of them. But the concern is that if there were a bad highway accident or something that involved a lot of people, the blood bank actually might not be keeping enough blood on hand to supply major hospitals in the Anchorage area or at any one of the other two dozen facilities around the state that need the blood, that contract with the Blood Bank of Alaska. So there's a concern there.
I gather it's been kind of hard getting information from the blood bank directly. So who are your sources and who are you getting information on this story from?
Well, some of those people I can't really talk about, but the person who filed the complaint to the FDA is Linda Soriano. She was the grant writer and development manager at the Blood Bank of Alaska.
And why did Linda Soriano, why did she come forward and how has she figured into what you've been able to learn about stuff?
Linda had access to some of the financial materials. In fact, one of the bigger pieces of the complaint that she wrote to the FDA was that blood bank leadership wasn't being transparent about their financials when they were applying for grants to state grant-making institutions like Rasmussen Foundation or Murdoch. So in her learning about those finances and her involvement there, she started asking more questions and got around to the issue of blood shortages.
B.J. Summers is a reporter with the Alaska Journal of Commerce. He spoke to Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. In a request for comment, a spokesperson wrote in email that the Blood Bank of Alaska began an investigation as soon as it learned of the allegations and said many of the claims are without merit, adding the organization is confident in its ability to safely provide blood to Alaskans. The Clearwater Lodge is back in business. 2 years after the old structure was burglarized and burned to the ground, owner Kevin Ewing has opened a bigger, fancier lodge in the same scenic spot on the banks of the Clearwater River near Delta Junction. Ewing says he's trying to rebuild his business while honoring the memory of the old lodge and its place in local history. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
Clearwater Lodge proprietor Kevin Ewing was hustling on a recent afternoon to help a crew set up a satellite TV system in time for his customers to catch that evening's pro football opening day games.
All we had before was just local channels, you know, just local TV, but now we're getting the satellites.
Ewing says he isn't converting the lodge into some kind of sports bar. The satellite TV system's just one of the many upgrades he's added in hopes of attracting more customers to the new lodge, which he's spent more than $1 million building, while at the same time preserving the funky, familiar feel of the old lodge.
The only thing that I knew was going to be hard to reestablish is the atmosphere. You know, the old lodge had that comfortable, come in, sit down, everybody knows you, you know, type of deal. And getting that back with a new building, I knew was going to be tough.
The new 7,200-square-foot lodge is more than twice as big as the old one. The exterior is framed with big, rough-milled timbers, including the big gables that soar over the front and back entrances and make the structure look more like a chalet than the log cabin built in 1954 that housed the old lodge. Ewing included some design touches to give the new lodge a rustic appearance, like the specially coated roofing that looks like it's rusting, and reclaimed wood siding that's finished to look faded and weather-beaten.
That's why I wanted to try and make the building look like it'd been here. So when you pulled up, it didn't look like a sterile new building that, you know, everybody kind of had to take their shoes off to come into.
The new structure does not, however, include the aroma of cigarette smoke and creosote that emanated from the treated timbers that were used for the old lodge's foundation. The new lodge is built on a concrete foundation, and the bar is smoke-free. Ewing's attention to aesthetic detail impressed Jenny Simmons and her husband Grant, a couple of tourists from Kansas City who were advised to check out the lodge while they're in town.
I love the exterior wood planks, the different colors in the wood.
They were equally impressed with the interior, which they got to see when Ewing invited them along for an impromptu tour.
I was taking pictures of the back of it, the front of it, the doors, everything. It's amazing.
They marveled at the salmon and grayling motifs carved into the timbers and cast in concrete inlays on the back deck in celebration of the Clearwater's legendary fishing tradition, which, along with snow machine races, attracted sizable crowds during the 1960s and 70s. And they were impressed by more subtle touches that commemorate the old lodge, like the weathered planks that Ewing used to build a facade along the front of the bar.
This was a tongue and groove I'd pulled off the roof before it burned, and I had stacked it, thinking, I'll use it someday for something. Well, yeah, and everything else was a total loss. There was nothing left.
The bar top, made from a big slab of birch, holds many bits and pieces of mementos entombed beneath a clear coat finish, including gold nuggets from a nearby mine and a set of keys.
Those were the keys that locked up the building the night it burned.
The May 14th, 2014 fire changed everything for Ewing and his wife, Patsy. It wiped out the family business and their plans for life after he finally retires from his pipeline job at Pump Station 9. It led to months of legal wrangling that finally ended in conviction of the arsonist and haggling with insurance companies over claims and lenders to secure financing for the new lodge. Ewing believes the stress of the ordeal is at least partly to blame for Patsy's death a few months after the fire due to health-related causes. He doesn't like to talk much about that, but he says with a note of irony in his voice that all the publicity about the fire and its aftermath seems to have boosted interest in his new venture.
He not only burned this place down, but a few months later, he burned down his next-door neighbor, which was a school teacher here in town, tried to burn her house down in a robbery. Stole a bunch of stuff and then tried to burn it down.
Ewing hopes all that publicity will serve a good cause and boost interest in the lodge in the months ahead after he completes work on two big banquet rooms that he hopes to rent out beginning this holiday season. And he'll need that interest for more projects that'll follow.
When the restaurant's done and open, you're going to relax?
No. I got a couple more building projects I want to do.
Those projects include some apartments he'd like to build to enable customers to stick around for a while, and a retirement home that he'd like to build on a piece of land just upriver from the lodge. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholt, Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tyler Stupp in Nome, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.